It's August 5, 2010, at the San Jose Gold and Copper Mine in Chile. And more than 2,000 feet below the surface, a couple of miners notice a faint rumbling sound echoing through the rocks. The miners have heard rumblings like this before as the rock adjusts to new excavations. But today, these rumblings are much more frequent than usual. The time is 2 p.m. and the workers are trying to wrap up as much work as possible before they will be picked up by a work truck, which will drive them all the way to the surface for lunch. But then, suddenly, they hear something much louder than the previous rumblings. The blast sends those working on the higher levels of the mine to the ground and causes the tunnels and shafts to collapse. Large rocks tumble down, sweeping across the workers, and all they can do is hang on to them and ride out. The workers have no way of knowing yet, but the San Jose mine has just collapsed, trapping them beneath the surface. The mine is located in the Atacama Desert, one of the driest areas in the world. Conditions here are so extreme that the site is often used for simulations of Mars expeditions. And yet, the Atacama Desert is an incredibly valuable asset to Chile. And that is because of what lies beneath. Abundant mineral resources, from copper to silver to gold. When looking at the mine from above ground, its true scale is hidden. To go in, there's an unassuming 5x5 meter entrance, and it leads to a tunnel known as the ramp that spirals downwards with several branching paths leading off into the mountain. The workers orient themselves underground based on a level system using sea level for reference. The entrance is at level 720, which is 720 meters above sea. When the mine collapsed, some of the workers were as deep as level 40. In the immediate aftermath of the collapse, some of the workers try to make a break for the surface. They get into a truck and drive up the ramp. However, they quickly get stuck, as the road is so littered with debris that they need to continue on foot. They reach level 190, where they find the cause of the collapse. A giant slab of diorite, estimated as tall as a 45-story building and weighing 770,000 tons, has broken off from the mountain and crashed down the mine, completely blocking the ramp. The workers are trapped, and their only option now is to retreat back down. Located at level 90, there is a small enclosed space known as the refuge. It is designated as an emergency shelter area for situations like this. Fresh air is pumped in from the surface, and emergency food and medicine is locked in metal cabinets that are to be opened should the need arise. As the workers descend back down into the mine, the word spreads of the collapse, until the news eventually reaches the shift supervisor, Luis Orzua, who is working at level 90. He orders the workers to take shelter in the refuge and heads down further into the mine to evacuate those working below. Because of the distance from the collapse and ear protection worn by the man, those down below didn't realize what was happening until Urzua orders them to the refuge. Once everyone has gathered together, Urzua then conducts a roll call and counts 33 men trapped. With the ramp completely closed, some of the workers realize that they might be able to escape through the ventilation shafts that lead to various parts of the mine. According to standard safety regulations, there should be ladders that can be used to climb through those shafts. To investigate this, a small group breaks off. But when they get there, they discover a heartbreaking sight. There's no ladder in the shaft. The owners of the mine never finished installing them. Back at the surface, the dust cloud has begun pouring out of the entrance. As the supervisors realize that something must have gone terribly wrong, one man who at the time of the collapse was driving up the ramp is able to make it out through the blinding ash of dust. With the supervisors present, one would expect immediate help would be organized. However, they decide that there is nothing they can do until the dust fully settles. Hours pass until they begin their descent down the ramp where they encounter the blockage. Standing face to face with the enormity of the diorite block completely obstructing the ramp, the supervisors realize that there is no coming through. And still, precious time is lost in the next steps. Despite having a phone line at the mine for emergencies such as this, the mine's owners decide to instead head back towards the closest town in order to get cell service to call for help. Finally, after more than 5 hours since the collapse, authorities are called. The news gets passed from the local fire department and onward until it eventually reaches the disaster office of Chile's Ministry of the Interior. The government deploys special forces in climbing gear with the hope that they could free the trapped miners. The idea is the same one that the miners had in the immediate aftermath, using the ventilation shafts as an escape route. As these forces climb down the shafts, secured to ropes, they are alarmed to see cracks in the walls of the shaft, a result of the diorite block pushing against the walls and squeezing the shafts. Despite the danger of another collapse, the rescuers continue on, determined to reach any man trapped below. They're able to make it to level 268 before they face a pile of rock and debris that looks as if it could fall on top of them at any moment. These shafts are way too unstable, and as they begin to retreat back, suddenly the rocks begin to fall around them, proving that their worries are justified. The rescuers manage to make it out of the ventilation shafts and back to safety. But now they need to report to those waiting anxiously on the surface that a rescue like this will be impossible. The only option left will be to drill. 2,300 feet beneath the rescuers delivering the bad news, the workers who returned from their own failed attempt at navigating the ventilation shafts must also return to the refuge, with bad news of their own. As experienced miners, many realize that this is going to take days, if not weeks. The enormity of what has happened hits some harder than others, and it particularly affects shift supervisor Urzua. Urzua makes an announcement that beginning with this moment, he is no longer the boss and that they will need to treat each other as equals. Knowing they are going to be trapped for long, the miners next take inventory of the supplies in the refuge, and the workers are soon met with another heartbreak. What was supposed to be enough food to feed an entire shift of workers for 2 days turned out to be one can of salmon, one can of peaches, one can of peas, 18 cans of tuna, 93 packages of cookies, 24 liters of condensed milk, 8 of them expired, 10 bottles of water, and some medicine, also expired. All of this will need to be shared among 33 men and has to last potentially for weeks. Looking at the meager food reserves, the men come up with a plan to make it last as long as possible. Every miner will get one meal a day, consisting of one cookie and one spoonful of tuna mixed with water that has been heated to turn it into a broth. It is a meal that has less than 300 calories, but it is all they can do. Drinking water, fortunately, is less of an issue. Even though they only have 10 bottles of clean, fresh water, there are large tanks nearby filled with thousands of liters of industrial water that is used to keep the engines of their machines cool. This water is drinkable, even though it isn't exactly desirable as it is contaminated with oil. With a somewhat stable plan for food and water set, a new constant threat begins to materialize. Mental collapse. Would anyone even be searching for them? Or would they just be presumed dead and the mine be sealed off? To keep these shadows at bay, one of the workers, an electrician, figures out a way to keep their flashlights charged. He does so by wiring them up to the large batteries of the work vehicles. And the miners even decide to use the artificial light to simulate night and day, keeping track of time and maintaining a comforting sleep rhythm for themselves. But the light isn't enough to fend off the shadows of the mind. And so, the pastor decides to step in. José Enríquez isn't actually a pastor by trade, but he is a devout evangelical man. The workers soon call him Pastor, a nickname that he earns because he leads the man in prayer. These prayer sessions become a fixture in the man's cycle. Have a restless sleep throughout the night plagued by nightmares, wake up to the artificial sun that is their flashlights, join together for a sermon delivered by Pastor Enríquez, and then eat a single meal of one cookie and broth made from oily water. And most of all, simply wait, never knowing if anyone is even bothering to search for them. Though completely separated from the society above, the miners created their own functioning society underground, from pastor to doctor. And although he had formally stepped down, Urzúa still was seen by many as some form of leader. You could think of it as a city below ground. And just like there was a city below, above ground, a new city also started forming. Many of the miners' families were frustrated by the lack of communication, and news reports offered confusing and conflicting information. Therefore, many wives and parents and children decided to head to the mine directly. One of the miners' sisters, Maria Segovia, immediately begins to take charge on behalf of other family members in demanding to know what is going to be done to rescue the miners. She declares that the families will camp outside of the mine until their loved ones are returned to them, and others follow her. Tents are brought out, and the families begin to sleep every night at the site. And every day, Segovia once again demands to know what is happening, until she and the other family members are pushed back and a perimeter is set up around the rescue site, with only authorized personnel allowed to enter. Not to be deterred, Segovia leads efforts to get more information by banging pots and pans at the edge of the perimeter, until an official comes over to let them know the progress. And with every passing day, the tents continue to grow into essentially a new city, and its residents decide to give it a name, Camp Hope. Meanwhile, Segovia also earns herself a nickname, La Alcaldesa, the mayor of Camp Hope. Without knowing about the formation of Camp Hope above them, by the time the third day underground comes about, the workers are increasingly worried. That is, until someone hears a faint sound in the distance. Everyone quiets and they listen together, scarcely able to believe it. It is the sound of a drill traveling through the mountain. Up above, a rotary drill has started its work creating a borehole down to an area close to the refuge, where rescuers correctly believe the workers to be. But there are some issues. The simplest method would be to drill straight down to their target. However, this would mean setting up the massive drilling rig right above the cavity left behind by the giant diorite block that has broken off. And because of that cavity, the ground is too unstable here. Therefore, the drill has to be set up at a different location, and the hole will need to be dug at a 78-degree angle. Their target is a small area, 32 feet wide, and they will need to travel through over 2,000 feet of diorite to reach it. If the drill deviates just by a small amount, by the time they reach the target, they could be completely off. It is at this point during the rescue that yet another person joins the operation. André Sugaret works as an administrator and engineer for the El Teniente mine in Chile. This mine is significantly larger than the San José mine, and rescues are much more common there, which makes Sugaret an expert in these situations. Once he arrives, Cigarette immediately gets to work, taking over and scaling up the rescue operation. He deploys 8 additional drills, all of them to run concurrently, each making its own borehole with the same target near the refuge. He knows they need to work fast, and the more opportunities they have to hit the target, the better. While the drills continue, Cigarette decides to simultaneously revisit the idea of using the ventilation shafts. He sends climbers back into the mine with the goal to clear these shafts. And as the rescuers get to work on this plan, they soon make a scary observation. They realize that the diorite block is actually still moving, slowly sinking lower and lower into the mine. It could completely collapse at any moment, and a difficult decision is made. The entrance of the San Jose mine needs to be closed and sealed off permanently, and they will need to put all of their hopes into the drills. And as if closing the mine wasn't bad news enough, the drilling is not going according to plan. After 3 days of digging, one of the drills is bending in the wrong direction. With no way to fix it, this hole will need to be given up on and restarted at a different location. And it's seeming more and more likely to rescuers that the workers down below would surely have perished by this point. The drills continue on, with few believing they will reach anything. When suddenly, the unthinkable happens. The drill has broken into a cavern in the mine. The loud drilling is stopped, and the rescuers think that they can hear a tapping sound on the drill. Scarcely able to believe it, they quickly bring up the drill in order to lower a camera instead. Once that is lowered, they turn the camera around the cavern, capturing the walls. But unfortunately, they see nothing but emptiness. With sunken hearts, they raise their camera back up. The tapping sound could have been anything, and they go back to drilling. Down below in the refuge, the workers are in a rough shape. It has been over 2 weeks since they've been trapped, and in order to survive longer, they now only eat every second day. They can see the weight loss on each other, and with now noticeably less energy, it is harder to keep moving. Some of the workers even venture down lower into the depths of the mine to see if the drill will break through somewhere there, but they realize it is too dangerous and head back up. Back on the surface, after so many failures, Cigarette has decided on a risky new approach. Instead of digging as fast as they can to reach the workers, they will now go painstakingly slow, sacrificing speed for better accuracy. It will take more days to reach their target, but if they keep missing, it'll take even longer anyway. The drills grind to half of their original speed. Days pass with this new slower approach, and by August 22nd, it has now been 17 days since the collapse. Many have privately given up hope, but none dare to voice their thoughts that it seems unlikely they will find anyone alive at this point. And then, it happens again. One of the drills reaches an open cavern near the target area, and once again, the rescuers think they hear tapping on the drill. Not wanting to have a repeat of last time, they brace themselves to avoid getting their hopes up. Once again, they send the camera back down. And this time, something peculiar happens. Once the drill reaches the surface, someone points out that there is a small palm-sized red smudge on the drill. Was that there earlier? Before they can investigate further, someone else notices that there is something attached to the drill bit. Tied to it with rubber tubing, there are pieces of paper. There's no mistaking this. Someone down below must have attached this. Carefully unwrapping the tubing, rescuers begin to read the 3 pieces of paper. The first is a note that points out where exactly the drill has broken through. The second is a personal letter to a family member, and the third is the one that completely changes everything. It says, "We are well in the refuge. The 33. Cheers ring out among the rescuers, as 17 days after first hearing news that their family members were killed by an accident in the mine, Maria Segovia and everyone else in Camp Hope hear the news that they have been all found alive and well.
euphoria in Chile as 33 miners are found alive in a collapsed mine.
It took 17 days to find the 33 miners.
Trucks carrying mining equipment are cheered like heroes in a parade.
But this is where the real work just begins. Now that the workers have been found, it's time to make first contact with them and figure out how to actually get them out. A camera and a makeshift phone is lowered down to the borehole, and the president of Chile, Sebastián Piñera, is there to speak with Urzúa, who confirms once more that they are all alive and uninjured. The most important first step is to get the man stabilized. Two additional boreholes are created to serve as a lifeline to the trapped workers. The first initial hole is used to send down supplies. The second hole is used for communication. And the third hole is intended to be used for later as a potential point of rescue to get the man out. And to the dismay of the miners, the first shipment of supplies isn't food, but rather bottles of glucose gel. Since they haven't had a proper meal in 18 days, the miners can't jump straight into real food or it will make them sick. They are happy to at least receive fresh water though, meaning they no longer need to drink from the industrial tank full of oil. The 33 miners also receive a shipment of medicine containing vitamins and vaccinations. Urzúa decides to appoint fellow miner Yoni Barrios as their resident doctor in charge of delivering the injections. And Barrios will routinely take the man's vitals, such as blood pressure, in order to report back to the medicine team above ground. Meanwhile, Cigarette starts coming up with a plan for how to get them out of the mine. All of the holes so far were narrow, but now they would need to drill a much wider hole, which they estimate could take up to 4 months. Time in which the giant diorite block could move further and potentially collapse the mine. To speed the process up, Cigarette decides to once again employ multiple strategies at once, and he comes up with 3 plans. Plan A is to use a drilling rig that is used in mines to create new shafts, called a Strata 950. It will first need to drill a pilot hole to reach its target, then drill the same hole to widen it enough that the man can be raised through. Plan B is to use an air core drill that typically drills wells, called a SRAM 2130XD. This one will use one of the 3 boreholes already created as its pilot hole and work to widen it first to 12 inches and then widen it once again to 28 inches. Plan C is to use a powerful oil drilling rig called a Rig 421 that won't need a pilot hole and can theoretically dig the required width in just one single pass. The entire operation would become known as Operation San Lorenzo, named after the patron saint of mining. While all 3 drills are busy digging, another team begins working on the capsules that the workers will need to enter in order to be hoisted up to the surface. To achieve this, officials from NASA are called in to provide advice to the Chilean Navy for constructing the capsule. And in total, 3 of these Phoenix rescue capsules are manufactured. Meanwhile, Plan C is running into an issue. This is a drill that should be able to create the rescue hole in just 1 pass. However, because of its massive size, the angle it has to drill, and because of the type of diorite rock it must chew through, it continuously wanders off target and needs to be stopped and recalibrated, significantly slowing its progress. The next issue comes with Plan B. Despite a strong start with significant progress made, reaching nearly half of the depth required in its first widening pass, the drill bit breaks off into the borehole, effectively blocking further progress and making the hole useless. And to make matters even worse, Plan A runs into issues with its hydraulics, causing its drilling to also come to a halt. The sounds of the drill stopping sends panic and anxiety through the man trapped below, as it becomes more realistic that their rescue really may not come for several more months. Most of the miners' hopes were pinned on Plan B. And so rather than giving up on the borehole and starting all over again, the engineers came up with a different idea. They devise a special metal contraption that is lowered into the hole and is able to retrieve the broken bit. And surprisingly, it works. With the path cleared, drilling for Plan B can resume. News that come as a relief to everyone.
Hoy es el día. Today is the day. As we speak, rescue teams are continuing to test an empty capsule to make sure that it's safe enough for the miners when they make the journey up.
They'll be told to keep their hands in and their faces back as that door closes.
Finally, after 65 days of being trapped underground, what everyone has been so eagerly waiting for happens. The Plan B drill finishes widening its borehole enough that the team can lower the Phoenix capsules through, and the rescue operation can enter its final phase. First, a rescuer is lowered down into the borehole in order to assist the man from the bottom with instructions on how to enter the capsule and make sure they are properly secured. And when this rescuer reaches the bottom and steps out of the capsule, the 33 workers finally get their first sight of someone other than themselves, someone from up above. And now it's time to start sending the man up, one by one. The order in which the man will go up has already been determined, and first up is the shift's foreman, Florencio Avalos. He and the three men who will follow after him are deemed the most fit, and so if something goes wrong, they will be most likely to be able to extract themselves from the capsule and make their way back down the borehole. As Avalos begins his ascent up towards freedom, he begins to feel cool air the closer he gets to the surface. The entire journey takes about 15 minutes, and as his head pokes above ground, he catches a glimpse of a crowd of people in hard hats, breaking out in cheers of joy and celebration. Up there, he is reunited with his family and greeted by the rescue crew, as well as by the Chilean president. After Avalos is successfully extracted, the next three fit workers are brought up, followed by those deemed most at risk.
Joy for the rescued miners and pride for an entire country.
It's the greatest underground rescue the world has ever seen.
Each cycle is faster than predicted, and though the rescue started at night, as the morning sun begins to rise, the remaining men are instructed to wear sunglasses in order to protect their eyes from the harsh sunlight after being underground for over 2 months. Finally, it comes time for the last worker to be raised up to the surface, shift supervisor Urzura. And cheers continue to ring out as he takes his turn to step outside of the castle. Next, he declares to President Piñera that, as the boss, he is now handing the shift over. All that's left of the rescue now is to bring up the rescuers who is sent down to aid in the operation, and to send the miners off to the hospital. All things considered, the workers are in great physical shape. All but two of the workers are released almost immediately, with one man needing further psychological tests, and the other requiring some dental work. After only a few more days, the last two men have been released as well, and all men are able to return home, where, in most cases, they would find themselves bombarded by journalists.
The rumors are proven to be true. There has been an agreement between the 33 miners that there are some things that could perhaps remain untold.
While they were trapped in the mine, the 33 had decided to make a pact. Should they be rescued, they will stand together as a unit and only talk to one person that they all agree upon as to how they survived. This way, no one man would profit of the story any more than the others. However, because of this pact, once the 33 were rescued, the universal support for the man trapped in a mine began to crumble. They did not speak with the journalists that continuously showed up at their door, and they refused to answer questions about what exactly happened in those 17 days before they were found. Almost as if in retaliation, the media began to fill in the gaps with their own stories about the man. And none were as apparent as the one that spread like wildfire about the miner who once acted as the resident doctor, Yanni Barrios. The story ran that he had cheated, and that his wife and his secret girlfriend first learned about each other at Camp Hope because of the accident. In reality, Chile, with a very Catholic population, had only just legalized divorce about 5 years prior. And because of how new the idea of divorce still was, many couples still legally remained married, just separated. Berrios' wife and girlfriend had known about each other for long before the accident, and Berrios himself mainly lived with his girlfriend. Yet, once journalists saw that Berrios had a girlfriend and a wife waiting for him in Camp Hope, before looking any further, they published the story of the two-timing miner. Many stories were also published that painted the workers as freeloaders, just looking for a get-rich-quick moment because of their ordeal. A wealthy businessman donated 5 million Chilean pesos to each man, equal to about $10,000, and some of the men traveled the world to appear on talk shows and meet celebrities. Stories were published that the workers were racking up gifts and expensive trips. And yet, in reality, any actual help or compensation for their ordeal was nowhere to be found. Not even within the legal system of Chile. After a three-year investigation, no charges were ever brought against the owners of the San Jose mine. The $10,000 they received dried up, and they needed to get back to work, with some of the men even choosing to go back to mining because that is what they knew. The story of the Chilean miners is undoubtedly inspiring, but it is also a story about how media attention works. If it weren't for Maria Segovia creating noise, the world might have never noticed this story. And as much as the world cared about the men when they were trapped down below, once they were up, the happy ending story was completed, and these men were forgotten. The Chilean miner rescue is a powerful story of human perseverance. And perseverance can come in many forms. Sometimes it can begin with a simple choice. The choice to risk everything for a chance at something better. Such as in my video about the incredible balloon escape. Back when Germany was a divided country with a brutal border strip that made it impossible to flee from the East German dictatorship, two families came up with an insane idea. They decided to build their own homemade hot air balloon, and they would risk their lives to try to fly to freedom. It is a thrilling story, and I actually got to interview Günter Wetzel, one of the men who built the balloon. This documentary is part of my Nebula original series called Under Exposure. And apart from the balloon escape, I also created a film about Flight MH17 that crashed over eastern Ukraine, detailing how investigators were able to trace back exactly what led to the crash. Or my documentary about the Bin Laden raid, where I mapped out exactly what happened when a US SEAL team stormed the compound of the Al-Qaeda leader. These are videos that are not made for the YouTube algorithm, but unrushed storytelling. And all of them are available right now on Nebula, which is a streaming platform that I'm building together with other creators. Since Nebula is a subscription service, it allows us to have higher budgets and create our dream projects. And on top of these exclusive videos, I also upload all my regular YouTube videos early on Nebula. So you can already watch my next video today. So go to nebula.tv/neo and make sure that you use exactly this link in order to get 40% of the annual plan. All my exclusive videos are up there. So thanks for the support, and thank you so much for watching this video.